Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Trump said today that he will wait until after the funeral services for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to announce his nominee to replace her. The decision, he says, will be made public by Friday or Saturday of this week. And here's President Trump speaking this morning to Fox News.
Look, the bottom line is we won the election. We have an obligation to do what's right and act as quickly as possible. We should act quickly.
Ginsburg's death and the pending nomination fight are raising the stakes in an already contentious presidential election, with Trump vowing to fill that vacancy before November 3rd. And Democrats are pushing for the choice to be made after the election. Let's bring in NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. And Domenico, Trump has said his pick will likely be a woman. How could pushing his nomination through the Senate galvanize key segments of that the president wants to win over, namely evangelical voters?
Well, I think it would be just a reassurance for evangelical voters that he's continuing to fight for them. I mean, they have been continued to be among the strongest supporters of the president. So I don't think it really changed much direction or move the needle very much for him with that group in particular. But he does have to weigh whether this person can be sufficiently against abortion rights. He's going to have to do a little bit of vetting on the records of some of these candidates. He has a little bit of a head start, given that he had finalists for the last time that there was a Supreme Court pick that came up who are being named again in this. So, you know, they say that he's going to make a decision around Friday or Saturday, and the clock is already ticking.
Yeah, if Republicans try to push the nomination through before the election, I mean, what's the risk of losing the majority of the Senate? How does this affect Republicans in tight races?
Well, I don't know how much this specific seat is going to affect Republicans themselves in tight races, but it certainly ups the intensity, because we've already seen that this is a record enthusiasm level for this 2020 election on the basis of both sides of the aisle here. So, you know, I don't know that it's going to change the calculus very much. Not much has moved the needle very much. But before Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death, I had talked to Dr. Michael McDonald at the University of Florida, who's sort of the turnout expert in the country, and he said that he's expecting the highest turnout since 1908 for a presidential election, which would be north of 65% or more. And, you know, certainly the death of a Supreme Court justice who was a feminist and cultural liberal icon is only going to add to the intensity of that.
Mm-hmm. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is urging the Senate not to vote on Trump's pick until after the election. Here he is speaking yesterday in Philadelphia.
This appointment isn't about the past. It's about the future. And the people of this nation, are choosing their future right now as they vote. To jam this nomination through the Senate is just an exercise in raw political power. And I don't believe the people of this nation will stand for it.
Domenico, how do you think this vacancy change will change the way Biden approaches the final weeks of his campaign?
Well, you know, it's sometimes difficult to get Democrats fired up for the Supreme Court to understand the stakes, but there's some evidence that that's changing this time around. Over the weekend, Act Blue, which is a group that raises money for Democrats, said they took in $100 million from 8 p.m. after Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death was announced. So I think there are a lot of people who are willing to open up their wallets to try to get Democrats elected. I think that also it has to do with the issues on health care in particular. The ACA is again before the court, the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, protecting that law has been something that Democrats have tried to do over the last 3.5 years or so. And, you know, that's definitely one of the top issues for a lot of Americans. And Joe Biden is going to be focusing on that and protecting those with pre-existing conditions in particular.
With the 30 seconds I have with you, we're learning a few more details about services for Ginsburg.
Yeah, we're expected to see her, lie in repose this week. We're going to see her at Statuary Hall there at the Capitol on Friday. So you do wonder, as that's happening and people are paying their respects, how much President Trump is really going to be willing and able to get out front of this to get his nominee put forward right away.
NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, thanks as always.
Thank you.
That's some of the political. Is there legal footing here? Let's bring in Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at the Yale Law School. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Robin.
And we want to mention your grandfather also worked alongside a young Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. We want to ask you about that. But first, Emily, you know, Democrats crying hypocrisy, Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham and others blocked Obama's nominee back in 2016, saying the people should vote first. Now Republicans are saying, well, back then we were the opposition Senate. Now we support this president. Put aside the ethics of that reasoning. The Constitution does agree with them that they have the right to do this, right?
Yes, the Constitution allows the president to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and the job of the Senate is advise and consent. And so, you know, I think whether or not there is huge hypocrisy here, if Republicans want to move forward and they can do so quickly, they have the power to make this happen.
And what if the election is contested? Is there any question about a president appointing a justice who will then decide his election?
There is nothing in the Constitution that would prevent that from happening. It's really just about the politics and how that would sit and how incredibly divisive that would be. And I would think that the other members of the Supreme Court, if such a decision were before them, would do everything they could to prevent that from happening because they know that it would bring the country to the brink of real crisis.
Well, Emily, we know that just a few days after the election on November 10th, the court is scheduled to take up the Affordable Care Act, questions about Obamacare. If this justice is confirmed, you know, by the election, would the justice immediately be on that court to consider that? And I guess secondarily, if the justice is not confirmed and this carries over into the new year, does that Supreme Court go ahead and consider the ACA with one justice missing?
If this new justice is confirmed in time, yes, he or she would sit and hear that case and could be the deciding vote in that case, because Chief Justice Roberts did side with the liberal bloc in previous challenges to the Affordable Care Act. If the justice is not seated by then, the court could decide to delay argument in the case because otherwise there could be a 4-4 split. And to hear an important case like that without a full complement of judges, of justices, when they're about to get a new one might seem to them like kind of a waste of time. So you could imagine them just delaying the argument in that case.
Yeah. And what if the president loses the election and it's obvious, you know, sooner rather than later? Is there any question about a lame duck Congress, maybe one in which some Republican senators also lose their seats but are still sitting till the inauguration? Any question about a lame duck Congress pushing through an ex-president's nominee?
I mean, again, there are huge political questions about this. Is this really what the American people want? What would the repercussions be? But legally speaking, whoever is sitting in those Senate seats on the day the vote is taken, those people get to vote.
Yeah. Well, the one thing we know for sure, the president said he's going to nominate a woman. The front runner seems to be the federal appellate court judge Amy Coney Barrett, seen as an ideological heir to the late Justice Antonin Scalia. What do you think we should know about her?
Amy Coney Barrett has made it clear that she's a staunch conservative. She has talked about precedent, previous decisions, in a way that it makes it, I think, fairly clear that she doesn't necessarily see Roe versus Wade, which protects the constitutional right to abortion, as a binding case. And she's young. And I think because of that, appealing, it seems like she's someone who would be on the bench for a very long time.
And finally, Emily, as we said, your grandfather, you know, ships passing in the night with Ruth Bader Ginsburg when they were both on the same court. What was his sense of her?
My grandfather's sense of Justice Ginsburg in her first few years on the D.C. Circuit, which were his last years, was that she seemed like a moderate to him. My grandfather was a kind of liberal champion, and he differed from her in a couple of cases involving the rights of criminal defendants. She sided with Justice Scalia. He was then also on this same court, instead of my grandfather. When she was nominated for the Supreme Court, feminists actually thought that maybe she was too much of a moderate. They were worried because she'd expressed some doubts about Roe versus Wade. She turned out to be an ardent champion of protecting the constitutional right to abortion and, of course, for equal rights for everybody. But it's interesting to remember that moment in her career when people just weren't so sure how she would turn out to be as a justice.
Mm, right. And just very briefly, your personal thoughts on her passing.
Well, I mean, I knew Justice Ginsburg. She was enormously kind to me, and she just was a mensch, in addition to being obviously an incredibly accomplished and important jurist.
A mensch, a good person. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine, fellow at the Yale Law School. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
This week, we're participating in a global journalism collaboration of more than 400 news outlets called Covering Climate Now. Of course, we're also still covering the coronavirus, as we have been for months. And our next guest says those two stories intersect in so many ways. She says coronavirus is like climate change on steroids, a problem threatening lives and livelihoods that requires immediate collective action and the expertise of scientists. And just like climate change, COVID-19 has become a crisis on a scale so large that it's hard for us to comprehend what's happening. Joining us now is Emily Atkin, climate journalist and founder of the climate newsletter and podcast Heated. And Emily, let's start with some of the obvious intersections of climate change and the pandemic. Early on, there was actually some hope that COVID-19 lockdowns could cause global emissions to fall. And now, months later, what have we seen happen to climate change prevention efforts amid the pandemic?
I think anyone who pays attention to climate change knew from the beginning that the narrative that nature was healing, that this was going to help with climate change, was a bit of a misguided thought. Just because climate change is so long-term, it has always and will always require long-term emissions reductions, something we do for a few months or even a year. If we ever go back to quote-unquote normal emissions, it doesn't really make a difference. And so I think what I saw when this happened was when these emissions reductions and the nature is healing thing started, I thought, well, maybe this will give people an idea of what it looks like to have a little bit of a cleaner world, and maybe that will be inspiring. Mm. But the fact that our emissions went right back up and stayed basically the same was not surprising. It's always been clear that we've needed long-term emissions reductions.
And then I'm thinking about what climate change is showing us in real time with the wildfires in California, for instance.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, the way that that intersects with coronavirus is just awful. Knowing how important it is to be able to go outside and hang out with your friends, social distance, and then you can't go be outside and be with your friends because of the smoke or even because of the imminent danger. The way that these crises are intersecting is certainly troubling to me.
Let's talk a little bit more about that intersection and these parallels. So earlier this summer, we asked Kim Cobb, a climate scientist at the Georgia Institute of Technology, if she saw a connection. Here's what she said.
Well, unfortunately, the parallels for me are very stark. Climate science has been watching this train wreck happen for several decades now, and this pandemic train wreck is very similar. You're sacrificing what you think is public health and well-being for short-term economic gain, but what you are really doing is baking in long-term economic damage.
I mean, what she's saying here really makes me think about, are we so short-sighted with both climate change and the pandemic that we can't see down the line to the inevitable pain?
The short answer is yeah. I mean, it's not even that, though. We can't even see the pain that climate change is causing us right now. I mean, last year, in 2019, climate change contributed to extreme weather events that cost at least $100 billion in damages, if not more. And scientists estimate that by 2050, if we don't drastically reduce our emissions, the cumulative damages from climate change may reach $8 trillion a year. Mm. When you think about the sweeping climate change plans that have been proposed by Democrats in Congress, they rank among the trillions of dollars. But compared to the prospect of an $8 trillion loss per year, it doesn't actually seem that like that much. And those are the numbers that we're not thinking about. When people say solving climate change, these climate policies are too damaging economically, it's like, compared to what?
I want to go back to what you were saying, that it's not even that we're short-sighted on the future, but that we can't even see what's happening right now. I mean, back to that whole thing about our world healing at the start of the pandemic, people did mobilize as individuals, even before the government did. We stopped eating out. We started wearing masks. But now, you know, 6 months in, has seeing people respond to the pandemic shaped your view or changed your view on the kind of impact that individual choices have on climate?
Oh, my God, so much. I mean, I still fully believe that we're not going to solve climate change unless we tackle big systemic problems. The fact that we use so much fossil fuels to power our economy, the fact that animal agriculture is so polluting, these are systemic issues, and they can't really be solved on an individual level. However, the beginning of coronavirus really made me realize how much power individuals have to change culture and to pressure governments and corporations to do what's right. If we're all doing individually what's right, and then we see the people with power not doing it, that creates pressure to create change. However, I think now, you know, you're seeing the effect of what happens when individuals make sacrifices for a really long time and then don't see commensurate change in governments and in businesses. Mm-hmm. You get downtrodden. You'd start giving up. And everything starts to fall apart.
Well, another systemic problem is racism. I mean, we see the parallels between climate change and this pandemic and how it's disproportionately impacted Black, brown, and poorer communities. I mean, climate change is basically doing the same thing. So how does that shape our country's response to both of these crises?
Yeah, it just means that the people most affected by both of these big problems, they're the ones that have the most to lose, you know, Black and brown communities, because of systemic racism. Those are the people that are most affected by climate change. And then they're dealing with the pandemic. That affects everything, just because those people are dealing with a lot, and they cannot adequately advocate for themselves. I think something that the pandemic has taught us all is that when you are going through so much pain and struggling, it gets hard for you to do your job, to take care of your kids, and then the last thing is to advocate for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So it really takes the work of other people who are more privileged to push for that work on both ends, so that everyone understands that these are all interconnected issues. We're all working for the same thing, which is an equal society that's not on fire and not plagued by a pandemic.
So, you know, a counter, though, to all of this is, why talk about climate change during a pandemic? We're spending trillions of dollars as a country to get out of this crisis. Is there any bandwidth left to actually move on climate policy?
I mean, it doesn't matter what the bandwidth is, really. People might not think that we have the bandwidth, but you have to make the bandwidth for both of these things, because climate change didn't stop for the pandemic, clearly. I mean, we can't just pretend that we only have the capacity as human beings to deal with one thing at a time. Both of these crises threaten millions of lives and economies. Honestly, for me, the pandemic made climate change seem more relevant, not less relevant. And the good news is there are solutions, economic recovery solutions for the coronavirus that include climate policies, job creation, mm-hmm. economic stimulus policies. There are other countries that are doing just that. I just read about the EU proposing a plan, an economic recovery plan that included lots of green energy investment for their coronavirus recovery plan. It's possible, and it's something forward-looking. Can you imagine proposing something in Congress that actually solved that actually purported to solve two problems at once and how exciting that might be.
You've said this has made you feel that this is an even more urgent problem, but do you worry that as a society, we're just going to go numb? I mean, we're getting used to seeing all of the death to the fires and the orange skies. This has made you feel more of a call to action, but are you fearful about folks going numb?
No, not at all, honestly. I know that some people do go numb, and we have to give people time to feel numb about these things, but I don't recall any time in human history where people have just gone completely numb to tragedy. There's always been large groups of people working against injustice, whatever it is. I often argue that anger is a catalyzing emotion. For so long, we looked at climate change as something that was just our faults because we had driven our cars too much, because we had eaten too much meat, and there was nothing that we could do about it because, of course, not every individual is going to do what's necessary. So we were sad about it, and it was always presented that way in media narratives about it. And I think, you know, the same thing happened a bit with coronavirus too, where we were like, oh man, this virus is just taking over and there's nothing we can do because people just aren't staying inside. But the more both crises go on and the more we learn about it, we realize, wait, this wasn't me. This wasn't my fault. There were failings at the highest level of power for the people that were supposed to protect us, that promised us they would protect us, that pull the levers on what happens with both of these crises. And then you realize that you actually, in a democracy, have the power to change that. So I don't fear that people will become numb. What I fear is that information will be suppressed. I fear that people will get the wrong information and they'll continue blaming themselves and continue thinking that they don't have the power to change these things. That's my fear.
Emily Atkin, founder of the climate newsletter and podcast, Heat It. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for having this conversation.
As summer officially comes to a close, Phoenix, Arizona will stay toasty with temperatures in the triple digits. Summers in Phoenix are always infernal, but this one was the hottest and driest on record. From member station KJZZ, Kathy Ritchie has this reporter's notebook.
Phoenix has two seasons, hot and hotter. And when it's hot, we know how to escape the relentless heat. But not this summer. Not just because we experience a record-smashing 53 days when temperatures were 110 degrees or higher, but Arizona was a hot spot for the coronavirus. And in a lot of ways, life was canceled. Dr. Amy Kafer is a Phoenix-based psychiatrist. She says at the start of the pandemic, she saw a huge anxiety spike among her patients.
And then after people being stuck at home for a long time, that the depression started to kind of overtake the anxiety.
So, context. First, we were dealing with all the uncertainty. Schools had closed abruptly back in March. Families were left to juggle working from home and homeschooling kids at the same time. And there was no toilet paper. By mid-May, Arizona had reopened for business, but then the number of coronavirus cases started to climb, and it got hot, really hot, and cabin fever set in. Here's Kafer again.
If you wanted to get into the DSM-5, call it an adjustment disorder, but I think it was kind of a collective adjustment disorder for everybody at this late stage in the summer.
Things are slowly reopening again, but for roughly 4 months, those escapes we rely on year after year were closed. Pools, water parks, libraries, movie theaters, gyms. Even the Salt River, just east of Phoenix, was closed to tubers due to the high risk of spreading COVID-19. And we're not done with the heat. The triple digits are lingering, and people are still home, which means air conditioners are cranked. Aaron Fagan is a service manager with Gettle Air Conditioning and Plumbing in Phoenix.
It's been absolutely insanity this year. We've been so busy compared to, you know, prior years.
And if 2020 has taught us anything, it's that if something can go wrong, it absolutely will. Like your AC going kaput.
We had guys out till 1, 2 in the morning sometimes, you know, doing service calls. And the homeowners wanted us there. They, you know, it was that late and they were happy to see us.
Of course, not all living things can rely on the miracle of air conditioning. Take Arizona's iconic saguaro cactus, which can grow to be more than 40 feet tall.
We hear from time to time, you know, like once or twice a year that somebody say, hey, one of my saguaros is leaning, what can I do? But this year, it has definitely been very exceptional.
Raul Puente is a research botanist at the Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix. He's talking about something that's happening to our beautiful saguaros. They're falling over. Like, they're melting.
I think that there are several reasons, but the heat is definitely the main cause.
And lack of water. Saguaros are in tune with the weather, so like us, they were expecting the annual monsoon, but that too fell flat this year. Unable to replenish lost moisture, the saguaros were left high and dry. And there's something else, says Puente. Saguaros perform photosynthesis in the evening when temperatures are supposed to be cooler.
What is happening, we see during the summer, and especially this year, is that it's still midnight and we're closing to 100 degrees.
And that's too hot for saguaros to turn carbon dioxide into food or energy. It's not supposed to happen that way. Then again, nothing in 2020 has happened the way it was supposed to. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie in Phoenix.
Dozens of fires continue to burn up and down the West Coast. Fire crews getting a handle on some of them, but many will be burning for a long time. Let's touch base for just a couple minutes with KPCC's Jacob Margolis in Southern California. Jacob, give us an overview of the whole state.
Yeah, even though some of the coverage of fires in the West has died down, we're still very much on fire. Right now, we've got 22 large fires in California. 18,000 firefighters are working pretty much nonstop, and a lot have been going nonstop since about July. Some of the biggest fires or most notable ones are the August complex up in Mendocino. It's at 837,000 acres, by far the biggest fire on record, only 34% contained. Then we've got the Creek Fire that's torn through Sierra National Forest. That is still going. It is only 27% contained. And here in Southern California, we've got the Bobcat Fire. That is over 100,000 acres, one of the largest in LA County history, and is not contained at all. It's threatening multiple counties and burning homes. It's very, very sad.
Tough. Well, how about air quality? Is that any better?
It's improved in part, at least in LA, due to wind flow, but other people in other parts of the country are suffering, or in our areas are suffering, and we should be very concerned about the health impacts. I heard from some researchers at Stanford that they're seeing an increase in the number of asthma cases coming in, as well as strokes at Stanford Hospital, although that data needs to be ferreted out a bit. But yes, the whole nation is being impacted by our smoke right now.
Well, just briefly, some of California's worst fires come later in the fall. Do you get a sense of what's to come?
It's going to be hot. We're waiting for Santa Ana winds, which are 60-plus mile-per-hour winds that can push fires across L.A. all the way to the ocean. That is our traditional wildfire season. So, you know, fingers crossed
it's
we
tough.
Hold up.
KPCC science reporter Jacob Margolis, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, to COVID-19. Are you doing the right thing and wearing masks, but maybe missing smiles? We may have a solution. First, wearing masks and social distancing is the best way to curb COVID-19 right now. Despite President Trump downplaying masks and holding packed rallies where few people wear them, his top health officials were all over the Sunday morning shows pleading with people to wear a mask. So good for you if you're wearing one. But yes, we miss smiles, which is why it was so disorienting to see a little girl round the corner in the store the other day grinning at me like crazy through her cloth mask. What? It's what's known as a clear panel mask. A number of companies are now making them. The online company Rafi Nova, based in Needham, Massachusetts, which sold handbags and accessories till COVID-19, calls theirs the smile mask. We're going to have pictures at hearnow.org. You have to see this. Marissa Goldstein is co-founder of Rafi Nova. Hi, Marissa.
Hi there.
And also with her, Olivia Gamble, a licensed speech and language pathologist who helped design the smile mask. Olivia, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And Marissa, if you could just start by describing the mask. Again, we'll have a picture at hearnow.org.
Sure. So the Rafi Nova smile mask is made with three layers of cotton fabric, and it has a panel that's made with BPA-free recycled plastic. It can have adjustable ear loops or a tie behind, one size for adults and one size for kids.
Okay, and so the plastic is the part that goes over the mouth. Is there a seal, a solid seal between the plastic and the material?
There is a solid seal on the mask. This is a non-medical mask, but it's been tested by several universities, and it is a safe and effective mask.
Well, and we want to note that doctors say that these smile masks can be as safe as regular cloth masks. Dr. David Aronoff at Vanderbilt says that if properly constructed, they might be even safer because durable, you know, synthetic materials like plastics can provide, you know, a strong barrier to droplet dispersal. What's interesting, we've been thinking, we wanted to do a story on how the hard of hearing and the deaf were faring during the pandemic, because, of course, many need to read lips. And we understand that was your inspiration as well, Marissa?
That's correct. I'm someone who's always smiling. And I would joke around and say, like, hey, guys, I'm really smiling right now, but you would never notice because I have this mask on. And then Olivia, who's a speech and language pathologist, she brought up the need for those that are deaf and hard of hearing, that they're not able to participate in the conversation while wearing masks.
So speech sounds are dampened by both a mask's fabric and by distance, which makes it really difficult to communicate effectively during this time of social distance. And as well, many members of the deaf and hard of hearing communities rely on lip reading to aid in their understanding of a conversation. Those who wear hearing aids, especially behind the ear hearing aids or cochlear implants, may have a lot of difficulty wearing traditional masks that have ear loops, because when you start to pull off an ear loop, it may take your hearing aid off with it. And so we designed the smile mask to have two tie-behind straps that will accommodate for these hearing aids and cochlear implants. And the reception has been extremely positive from both members of the deaf community to teachers, speech pathologists, audiologists, you know, members of all different, you know, working fields.
We created a special teacher package on our website a few months ago, and it just caught on like wildfire. In probably a 2-week period, we made 200 to 300 prototypes that we were just constantly fixing and changing and making better and better. And so we really condensed this prototyping timeframe, which would normally be several months, into just a few weeks, because we knew that we had to get this product out into the market.
Okay, so now we move from the beginnings of your smile mask to, you know, where it is now, not just the deaf community, but I saw it on a little girl. It turns out her whole school has ordered them. Olivia, tell us more about that as someone who specializes in speech.
You know, children who are learning about emotions may have difficulty recognizing these emotions through facial expressions and tone of voice when teachers or peers are wearing masks. I can also speak to this from, you know, a speech perspective, where children who are learning phonics and speech sounds, they require like this visual representation of tongue and lip placement. Language comprehension relies not just on the words that we say, but how we say it. Children look at our eyes, our lip movements, and cheeks to all aid in this comprehension.
Well, and, you know, adults, I mean, some people are loving the masks because there's a certain mystery to it.
Sure.
We wear much less makeup. But, you know, and it's become kind of a fashion statement in some corners. But people are missing the smile. And I did a little research on the Duchenne smile, named after the scientist Guillaume Benjamin Armand Duchenne. I'm sorry if I'm murdering that. But he was a neurologist who studied this idea that this huge smile that just spreads across your face and not only lifts the corners of your mouth, but also affects your orbicularis oculi, the muscles around your eyes. We really need to see that big smile. And by the way, we should point out, you know, the deaf in their own communities might each want to have these masks, but it's equally important for their colleagues to have the masks, because that's who they're trying to communicate with.
Absolutely. These masks aren't just for the actual members of the deaf and hard of hearing communities, but they're for everybody around them as well. It's really important if you're at a grocery store, you never know if you'll encounter somebody who relies solely on lip reading to communicate.
Marissa, one quick question. So those of us wearing our masks that have glasses are fogging up our glasses all the time. What do you do about the breath on the plastic?
That's a great question. So there will be some fogging. We've partnered with a company out of Indiana. We have an anti-fog solution, and you just apply a few drops onto the mask before using it and you wipe it. It reduces fog and condensation from forming on the mask.
Kind of like a ski goggle. Again, we'll have the pictures at hearandnow.org. It's got a certain flair of its own as well. It kind of has a Joker quality when you, you know, because you can see the smile and then there's a frame around it. You look like the Joker. But it, I can't tell you what, I mean, I stopped in my tracks when I saw that little girl smile at me. It was the first one I've seen from a stranger in a long time.
Yeah. And we actually, we first pivoted in late March because we had just launched our bag company and there was no customers, obviously, because COVID was spreading. And my husband and I have been living overseas in Vietnam for the past 4 years with our two sets of twins. And we've been in the manufacturing industry. And so we knew in late March when there was like no masks available, we knew that we could convert our production lines from bags to masks. And so we started off by just making masks to donate to frontliners. We had no intention of selling them. And then people were begging us to sell them. And so we put them up on our website and it just grew from there. But our first intention was really to just help the community.
Marissa, Olivia, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us, Robin. Take care.
A new report by the CDC finds that where you sit on a long flight could significantly increase your risk of contracting COVID-19. For instance, on one 10-hour flight back in March, a passenger in business class likely infected about a dozen other people. This was before airlines had enforced mask requirements, but now that they do, how great is the risk of getting an infection during a long flight? We posed that question to Derek Thompson, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington as he does each Monday. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So this finding is kind of what we all expected and kind of worried about. What's the likelihood of spread on flights, especially long flights, if passengers are wearing masks?
So I think it's important to be very clear about what this paper concluded about a long-haul flight back in March versus what we know about flying today. So this paper found that a sick woman got about a dozen other passengers sick in business class when in all likelihood none of them were wearing masks. And to be honest, knowledge of this disease back in March was relatively minimal. But today, mask wearing is universal on flights, and it's enforced on planes. I just flew to Maine last week and observed this myself. The uptake on masks was 100% and very easy. And people who have symptoms of respiratory infections are much less likely to travel because they know, unlike in early March, that we're clearly in the middle of a global pandemic. So for those reasons, there have not been many infections traced to airplanes in the last few months, nor have there been infections traced to similar transportation settings like Tokyo subways. So what this study should tell us overall is not that traveling in airplanes is dangerous, period, but rather that traveling in airplanes was dangerous in February and March before we had contemporary guidelines, including the universal use of masks.
Okay, but I want to ask you a little bit more about indoor environments without good ventilation systems. So over the weekend, the CDC on its website posted new guidelines agreeing with scientists who have long been saying that COVID-19 spreads through tiny droplets that remain in the air. Now the CDC says that guideline was actually an error on its site. That's according to the Washington Post. But this idea that indoor environments without good ventilation increases the risk actually seems intuitive, and airplanes are enclosed places, right?
Yep, it's a really good point. Intuitively, it seems like airplanes are one of the worst places you could possibly be, but there's two reasons why they might be much safer than something like, say, an indoor restaurant or a bar. Number one is that airplanes are much better ventilated than, say, you know, a downstairs bar in a 100-year-old building. Airplanes actually have extraordinary ventilation compared to almost every other indoor setting of the same variety. The second thing is that when people are on planes, typically they aren't talking very loudly. And one of the most important ways that we produce these small droplets, these aerosolized droplets, is by talking. When you and I speak, we are spewing little tiny, practically invisible droplets into the air that are floating around for maybe several seconds or even several minutes. And those droplets, when inhaled by somebody else, if they are infected by the virus, if the virus is in those droplets, can get those people sick. So if you combine the fact that people are wearing masks with the fact that they tend not to be screaming and shouting on an airplane to each other, with the fact that these airplanes tend to be pretty well ventilated, you have a space that just isn't quite as dangerous as it might seem, given the fact that, yes, as you said, they are relatively closed indoor environments.
Yeah. Also, does the type of mask you wear matter in these instances when you're on a plane or in enclosed environments?
The type of mask is important. Some masks are definitely better than others, but the fact of wearing a mask seems to be more important than that that mask be some certain scientific or technological grade that's very sophisticated. The Japanese, I think, really have the best sort of three-part explanation for how to think about staying safe when you're out and about outside of your house. Number one, closed spaces with poor ventilation, that's dangerous. Number two, crowded places like bars. And number three, close contact settings, especially close range conversations. Those are their three C's: closed spaces, crowded places, close contact settings. If you pay attention to those three C's, you can pretty much count on being safe anywhere.
You know what? Thinking back to what we just talked about that 10-hour flight back in March, I mean, why isn't, though, contact tracing happening more frequently in air travel, aside from the fact that when that happened back in March, we weren't wearing masks?
This is a great and really important question. The U.S. has completely dropped the ball when it comes to contact tracing. There are a lot of countries, especially in Eastern Asia, that have done much better when it comes to contact tracing. We have not set up the infrastructure, either at the state level or the federal level, to do the same. Now, yes, you did, I suppose, on this plane have contact tracing. That's why they could publish the study in the CDC. But we need to be doing a much better job at understanding how people are getting each other sick. You can't really do that without an organized contact tracing apparatus. We haven't built that up expeditiously here in the U.S. And it is one of the reasons why, if you compare our numbers, compare our deaths to other similarly advanced countries, we have had a lot more of both cases and deaths here in the U.S.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.